Session number 13660.
Mr. Saunders, real two.
Right. I was talking about this camp in Duzun Tour, which wasn't large enough to hold the whole unit, you see. And during that, I was on one or two lengthy patrols, which I must say I liked. And the bandits were like rare game, difficult to sight, and even more difficult to shoot. Even though we lay up all night, stormed into a camp, and that, you know, all doing, and I wasn't long with that regiment, only about 6 months. I never saw a bandit, let alone shoot at one. I think the idea was, again, you see, I was not in the higher councils of things. I think the idea was to drop us into the jungle by parachute or on foot and act as beaters to the cavalry regiments which were patrolling the rubber estates. You know, the most of Malaya is crisscrossed by rubber estates and oil plantations and so on, yeah. And palm oil plantations, and except for the jungle. Very much in the center, Kamun Highlands, Fraser's Hill, and up north, Kedah. All sorts of stories reached me about Colonel Mike. For instance, you see, Colonel Mike is one of these wartime chaps who, he was the sort of, like, rather like General Murad of Napoleon's, you know, do this, and he bloody well did it with dash and immense courage and drive, and regardless of losses. He did it. If he was told by Old Wingate to, if he had somebody behind him who knew about strategy and tactics, told him what to do, he would do it. But then, you see, after Old Wingate's death, he was lost. He didn't have a protector. There was a General Urquhart, there was a General Briggs, who asked Mike to write a thing for the defense of Malaysia with this. Sorry, this is my dog. With this increasing terrorist activity. The Briggs plan for Malaysia was produced. It was entirely written by Colonel Mike. But he was a missionary. As long as his ideas went into practice, he didn't care about personal aggrandizement. The Briggs Plan of Malaya, which worked, and has been written word for word by Colonel Mike. I mean, I was told by other people whom I met subsequently who were at war, the senior staff college with him when he was young soldier before the war, that he said, you can go to London, I'll write the report. You know, they have teams of three or something, or four or five, whatever, who work together as a syndicate. Do you know about Senior Staff College or not?
No.
Right. He then wrote down military plans, tactics or whatever, for certain situations, which are still now, they are sort of as a handbook of certain desert warfare, jungle warfare, or whatever. He was quite a brilliant man. I mean, in his secret reports, or what the confidential reports, earmarked by CIGS, you know what that is?
CIGS, yes.
The Stephen Pearson, general material. I mean, he was earmarked for promotion to general, even before the war, you know, because he was so brilliant. And he was a fighter. I don't know, he was a boxer. I don't know how, I'm not sure whether he was regimental or regional or army champion, but he was a boxer. He's a fighter, you know. And what I personally always criticized the establishment for, whatever I say, I don't want to detract from my admiration for this man's character, is that his private habits, which were a little bit untidy, were overlooked during the war. And when his administrative slips, it's very difficult to court-martial a man for maladministration. They used his private habits to court-martial him. And that, I thought, was a wicked thing to do. His private habits were an open secret in the army. Everybody knew about him, laughed a little bit, but respected him for his real soldierly qualities. So we don't want to go into that anymore. And this regiment and it suited him, almost in a state of turbulence, you see, because, as I mentioned earlier, he felt officers ought to exert their authority by personality and not by rank. And quite right, to some extent, when you're in the middle of a jungle and you have a junior officer and half a dozen or 10 men, if they don't respect him, they'll do what they like, you see. But I remember once we had a sort of a bit of a canteen, and when we came out of the jungle, some of the men were rowdy, and all the sergeant came in and asked to close down, and they told him to piss off. And all the officer came in and said, "Now, come on, this must stop," you see, and they told him to fuck off, you know. And then Colonel Mike came in and looked for the biggest chap there was, and took him out, held him short, punched him in the face, and said, now clear the place, you bastards, you know. He had this, it's unheard of normally in the British Army for a colonel to pick up a private soldier or a corporal and punch him in the face, but it worked, it suited him. And he rather liked this.
But did you see him do that?
I saw him do that, yes. And he rather liked
it. At Dusuntour?
In Dusuntour, you see. But everybody had to be armed all the time in case of terrorist attack, and it isn't funny for a junior officer who has not got the reputation of a hero to come into a room of fully armed men, some of whom turned their personal weapons against him, you know. when you sit there and you have you had these light rifles, carbines they called them, I think. Some of them had revolvers and pistol thing. But you had to be with your weapon all the time. But it isn't funny for a junior officer to come into a room of men near mutiny who turned their weapons against him, you see. Fetch Michael Carmen, he cleared it in 2 seconds, flat. You know, well, that was him. Also, he was asked by... Now, there I personally was, private soldier, colonel. That is another thing, is hearsay, which I heard at the Selangor Club. That was the club to which I had entree simply because of my connections with... Because I'm a life member of the Hong Kong Club. If you're a life member of any Far East Club, you have reciprocal arrangements with other clubs. You see, also I'm a member of the Carlton Club in London. Again, they have... but I'm sure they've never had a private soldier in the SAS who was a member of the Carlton Club. Nor, I believe, does the Beaufort Hunt have members who live in a council house on £2 a week. You know, because I live on income support and housing allowance, and of course these allowances are tailored to keep you from starving, but not for hunting with the Beaufort, you see. So I've always had these sort of incongruous situations in my life. Anyway, Colonel Mike was asked to lecture to the commanding officers on jungle warfare in Malaya by his protector, General Briggs.
Commanding officers of the battalions.
Look, Coldstream Guards, Somerset Light Infantry, Gurkhas, this and that, you know, to lecture to them on jungle warfare. And so Colonel Mike said, of course, the Guards will do this, and the Coilists, the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, will do that, and Somerset Light Infantry will do that, and the Gurkhas this, and so on. SAS will do that. So one furious... You mustn't forget, Michael Calvert was junior in rank was substantive rank to all these others. He was a brigadier at 31, and then he reverted to half colonel, but he was only a captain on paper or something, maybe a major. He was junior to all these chaps. You know, and they said, whatever they were, 17th, 21st, you know, all these double barrel cavalry regiments, usually commanded by double barrel gentlemen, you know, Colonel Horsburgh Porter, or Losley Williams, 17th, 21st, Innis Killing Dragoon Guards. I mean, I personally have a love for the 12th Lancers, which I wanted to join because I have so many chums. However, one of these furious half-colonels jumped up and said, "What's so special about the SAS? What can they do that we can't do?" And he hissed and said, "Nothing, but you don't do it." That's a true story.
Was Calvert right?
Absolutely. You know, because he created a unit of doers. You know, I mean, if I were given a map and told to do something, get yourself here, I bloody well did. Remember, you know, he had that quality of, I mean, you know, the sort of Murad thing, you know?
Yes.
Murad, he was not a tactician. He knew nothing about strategy. And he was a if Napoleon told Murad to do something, it was done, you know.
But what did the 21st SAS achieve in the jungle in Malaya?
Fuck all. But not, all we did is we acted as beaters to the cavalry regiments who on their wagons, whatever, you know, armored cars, patrolled the jungle. The whole of Malaya is really connected by unmarked roads of rubber estates and oil plantations and so on, you see. And that's where the bandits created nonsense and terrorized the workforce, bullied them into giving them money, rice, and so on. Well, that very gradually it dawned on me, I'm not going to get my commission as promised. Because I asked Colonel Mike, you know, at that time I got a bout of leptospirosis. You know what that is?
No.
Leptospirosis is, they call it Weil's disease, is drinking contaminated water from rats in the jungle. I mean, you're very, living in the jungle, you're very susceptible. And first of all, they treated one for malaria. And I must tell you this. We had one Rhodesian squadron which looked like young warlords. They were tall and blonde and blue-eyed, looked like professional rugby players. They went down like ninepins. The people who survived were the bendy-legged, rickety, wiry little people from the Gorbals in Glasgow and the east end of London, because they've been used to contaminated water and bad food all their lives. And they survived. And a lot of the Rhodesians died. I don't know how many, but quite a lot. I also survived. You can draw your conclusions from that, because I wished to survive. I wasn't going to give in. But we were very, very ill, you know, until it was discovered that it was leptospirosis. They treated us for malaria, the local MO.
What did you do for a water supply in the jungle?
Well, you went to some, if there wasn't a river nearby, there's lots of rivers in Malaya, but if there isn't a river, you just take some water from a little pool or something where I suppose the animals drink or bathe, whatever, and boil it, you know. But, I mean, a lot of people got leptospirosis. I should think at least 10% of the whole unit. But it's a very serious disease. It's a very severe bout of jaundice, really. That's what it meant.
What did you eat in the jungle?
Whatever you carried. And if you were... You mustn't forget, I came from skiing and was incredibly fit. In terms of horses, I was racing fit. Most of these other people were unfit. So I didn't mind carrying 30, 40 pounds. People who were lazy, they carried very little. and you slept. And some people were they slept on the ground because they couldn't be bothered to. You sling up a hammock, tied to trunks, always trees, and you have one rope, one thin nylon line going from one tree to another, and over which you hang your poncho. It rains almost every evening. Very rarely do you get a 24-hour rain-free. Most afternoon it rains heavily. During the night it's usually not, and then might get a shower in the morning. But you want to hang your poncho like a tent. And I always picked it. I always made myself an extremely nice camp, you know. But I didn't share my rations because I was very fit and carried a lot, and I didn't see why I should feed the other people. So some people were very hungry. Then, of course, you could shoot the odd deer, unless we thought we were near bandits, and we didn't, you see. And you could throw the odd, that is a horrible thing to admit, we threw the odd 36 grenade. There are these things, those little pineapples, you know, into the A River. And then upside, the things for every fish you get, you kill at least 20, 30 little ones, you see. And so that was our way of fishing. I mean, you carried your rations, whatever they were, in tins and what have you. And you got a rum ration. And there were airdrops. And you had to prepare a dropping zone, which had to be at least wider than from here to this little hut down there. And then Michael Calvert would, in fact, very often join the aeroplane, which would make to whom rations were to be dropped. We had to, by radio, ask for what we wanted, and they would drop once a week. There's an airdrop. And sort of you'd come over in a Dakota and speak to the signaler by some instrument or another. And I'm not a signaler, I know nothing about these things. He says, cold as a desert, see you next week, and bust off again, give us nothing that week. Desert is dropping soon. And then we were in the jungle, rations running out, nothing to eat. And he came after a second, because then he came again. But, God, I knew innumerable Michael Calvert stories, you see, because he ran the regiment in a wartime basis, you see, which just didn't work in peacetime. And every soldier got everything new once a week, because when you're walking in the jungle and sometimes in water and you get very smelly, and then you throw away the suit which you wore last week and wear the new suit for sleeping in. You know, because you couldn't sleep in the nude because of mosquitoes and things like that, you see. So you wore a uniform and socks and a jacket for sleeping in, and that one would next week would do for daytime use, and you threw that away, you see. And but of course that's another method which was disapproved of by the establishment. It's a very good way of supplying soldiers on active duty in the jungle, give them a complete kit once a week. You know, you got one pair of socks, one pair of trousers, we didn't wear underpants, one jacket, one pullover. Pullover is very important because mosquitoes can't sting you through it, you know. It gets quite cold in the jungle. And the thing which you wear, neck, sort of chief handkerchief, well, sort of a, is that what you call net thing, you know, wear around your neck. So we had everything new once a week, and that was thrown away. But as for myself, I don't know whether it was in 3 or 4 patrols which lasted weeks, you see. But you never see the sky; it's just a green hell, you know. And sometimes there's rivers, them not very wide, you see. But, I mean, you can't get lost in the jungle. I mean, anyone who got lost and died was because he of personal stupidity. You can build yourself a raft, there's plenty of bamboo about, lash it together, put your kit on it. Sooner or later, you slide down to the east or west coast. I mean, you cannot walk a day without coming across a river in Malaya. So a few people died, and I think they were just idiots. They would have perished anywhere, you know.
What did you think of the enemy?
Of what?
The enemy.
Enemy. They were just bandits, you see, and they were very clever, and they had a few training camps and things. But yeah, they spent their days in the cafes of Kuala Lumpur and other towns, you know. They just occasionally did something, a little bit of terrorist. You might as well say now what you think of the enemy in Northern Ireland. I mean, why are they not treated like ordinary terrorists and murderers or something? You can't catch them. They lead ordinary civilian lives in between their criminal activities.
What condition were they in?
Well, oh, well, the thing is that they, if you saw someone in a cafe who had leech bites on their arms, you may assume he is a terrorist and has been in the jungle.
So what did you do?
That wasn't our job. That was the job of the police who patrolled the towns and so on. Our job was really to try and find training camps and shoot them. And think, oh God, we lay up all night and got bitten by mosquitoes and charged or something and recently deserted camp. I mean, my experience, I have never seen a bandit, let alone killed one. So that's all I
when you were with the SAS in Malaya,
who was on top of things in the war? Was it the guerrillas who were on top, or was it the British?
I didn't know. I was a private soldier, and I simply I heard things in the Selangor Club in Kuala Lumpur when I went there in the evenings or something, you know, when I was back. But one felt they were gaining an unnecessary control of things, you know. I mean, Ernie Gurney, you know, who was murdered. You know of him?
Yes.
And that happened while I was there, you know, and I didn't know the ins and outs of it, you know. And there certainly one continuously heard. But you mustn't forget, my position was rather, I suppose, if a private soldier is stationed in Northern Ireland, he's told to patrol, he hardly knows what's going on, politically and certainly not tactically or strategically.
Did you get any impression of what the attitude of the ordinary Chinese was towards the guerrillas, whether they supported them or not?
Yes. The ordinary I didn't know many ordinary Chinese, but I had a feeling that they were watching with interest, and the Chinese... The Chinese are by nature, great jesters. I mean the whole of China. I mean, the Manchus aren't Chinese, who eventually ruled China. They came down from the north, and China. That's why I also feel communism does not succeed eventually in China, because China is too big. It simply absorbs conquerors simply by virtue of its size and population. Eventually, communism will also be absorbed and Chinese will come back to Chinese like they always were.
So the Chinese just wanted to see who was going to rule?
But eventually, the Chinese in Malaysia are they're visitors, you know, visitors of convenience through commerce and finance and so on. You must know that the population of Malaysia consists of the indigenous population who've been driven to the hills, and they're referred to as Sakai. That is a sort of a derogatory thing. The Malays, the majority of the people, they're like the Austrians. What they should do today, they do tomorrow. What they should eat tomorrow, they eat today. They are lazy, lovable, beautiful, lazy people. So you have a country where finance is in the hand of the Chinese, industry and commerce to a large extent in the hands of the Indians, and administration in the hands of the Europeans. And even though they're independent now, it is still so. Malaya is one of the few, I'm talking now, as of now, I've been quite there quite often.
But when you were in the jungle, did you come across the Sakai yourself?
Oh, yes, yes. We won them over in small groups, and they helped us and guided us, and they built our huts for us and so on, you know, and carried our burdens and so on. We came across them.
But do you think they were doing the same thing for the communists?
Absolutely. They are frightened hillbillies, you know, and they are bandy-legged little people, you know, who were driven away.
How did you like being in the jungle? Did you hate it?
I loved it. It's the next best thing to being in the Alps. I absolutely loved it.
Why?
Because we walked from A to B, and then I pitched my tent and made my little my tea with rum in it, you know, which I carried. I loved it. I was incredibly fit. To me, it was chicken feet, what was called upon to be done. Most of the others were exhausted. I was very fit. I was a ski instructor a few weeks earlier, or a few months earlier. And I simply like this business of the same thing. I like to be in the high mountains, you know, and I like, and I simply liked it very much. I mean, if whoever I was under at the time, who led the patrol, wanted a runner to go from A to B, I was always selected because I could be relied upon to arrive at the other end.
But what about all the discomforts in the jungle? Did they bother you?
There aren't any discomforts. The discomforts only exist near civilization, when the jungle is dense. The further you go in, the thinner it gets. Did you not know that?
Because of the light?
I don't know what the dense jungle. I mean, as soon as you're 10, 15 miles away from civilization, it's very open. You don't see daylight. It's all green, you see. But and you must have a good feeling of direction, of map reading and so on, you know, and the maps are not very accurate, but as I mentioned earlier, there's so many rivers, you can't ever get lost. You make your way to the nearest river and build a raft, if you like, and float down it. I mean, any person who perished in the jungle is an idiot or timid.
Why was it that you only did those three patrols with them?
Maybe four, I do not know. By that time, I thought that is not my sort of war. And then when I came back one day with very bad leptospirosis, which the MO thought was malaria, they then was diagnosed. And Colonel Mike came to see me in hospital and sat by my bedside. And he said, well, you know, this is all rubbish. I'm under a cloud, I may have to leave soon, and I think you better look around for something else.
But could you get out of it so easily?
Easily. I went, I heard that there was a chance for serving officers to get out into the police force. And I thought to myself, my goodness, I mean,